Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. How is your social distancing going so far? I think one of the really hard things about this pandemic has been to be suddenly cut off from so many people we love, people that are important to us, our friends. I asked about this on social media.
My name is Edie Weinstein. I'm from Dublin, Pennsylvania. And yes, I do miss my friends. I am a consummate hugger, so I miss having physical contact with them. This has taught me the importance of heart-to-heart connection with people, even more so.
I know this quarantine is necessary, but I miss my friends.
I'm Lucia Herndon. I'm a knitter, an activity that most people think is a solitary pastime. But I do most of my knitting in the company of fellow knitters. I miss the camaraderie, the support, the help.
Hi, my name is Natalie Diel. I live alone, so being able to FaceTime with friends has really saved my mental health. Friends are wonderful. They ground us, teach us, cheer us on, make us laugh, comfort us.
Lydia Denworth is also missing her friends and connecting to them on screens instead.
Just last night, I had a Zoom video conference, which I'd never used for anything other than work, with six of my college friends who are all over the country and even one in Canada. And we just spent an hour with our glass of wine in the evening talking about, you know, our anxieties and what was happening in our various towns. And it made everybody feel better. It made us feel more connected.
Friends make us feel better. We know that instinctively, but this is also something researchers have confirmed. Friends have a major positive impact on our lives, especially our health. They are part of what's allowed our species to thrive. On today's episode, we look at friendship, how friends affect our well-being, how we find them, and what happens when we lose them. So Lydia, who had the Zoom conference with her friends, she's been thinking a lot about friendship. She's a science writer who just published a book on this topic. It's called Friendship: The Evolution, Biology, and Extraordinary Power of Life's Fundamental Bond. And with everything going on right now, that seems like a perfect book for this time.
What friendship is really about fundamentally is being there to help each other, especially in a time of crisis. It's about helping people get through the stresses of day-to-day life. We are certainly having more stresses in our day-to-day lives than we are used to. And so what I think is essential is that people not pull away from each other. What I think we have to do in a time of social distancing is remember what friendship is about and then think more creatively and a little harder about how to keep helping each other, how to show up for each other from a distance.
Yeah, showing up without necessarily showing up.
Right. I think there are lots of ways to do that.
Hence, we're suddenly talking on the phone again or watching movies together remotely, hanging out in video conferences. But who are these people we're reaching out to? How do we define friends?
Well, that is a really important piece of the story, because one reason that scientists did not take friendship all that seriously for a long time is because it's hard to define and also hard to measure. And science depends on those things. You need outcomes to measure and variables to compare. You need a working definition. The problem with friendship, I should say, is that all of us, we think we know what friendship is. And yet, if you ask people, they will tell you different things. But so when scientists in different fields like evolutionary biology or anthropology started trying to come up with a definition, the same themes come up a lot.
Those themes boil down to three minimum requirements.
One is that it's long-lasting, so it's reliable and stable. The second is that it's positive. It makes both of the individuals feel good. And the third is that there's cooperation involved. There's some reciprocity and some give and take. And human friendships have more than those things often, but they must have those elements to be considered a friend.
Why do we need friends? What have researchers learned about that on a biological level?
Well, it turns out that friendship is as important as diet and exercise to your health, and it actually helps you live longer, and during your life, it will help you live healthier. And it has an impact on all kinds of things. It impacts your cardiovascular functioning, your immune function, your cognitive health, mental health, your stress responses, and even the rate at which your cells age, which is incredible, really, when you think about it, that the lonelier people biologically age faster than people who have more friends and are more socially connected.
And what do we think is the mechanism of that? How does friendship do that?
Well, that's what's so interesting. We don't have all of the answers yet, but I can give you an example. I mean, stress responses are kind of obvious, and they were one of the first things people guessed at, that when you're stressed and anxious about things, the cortisol levels in your body go up, and that's okay on a short-term basis, but it's not good on a chronic basis. And people who are more socially connected have more outlets. And we've seen now that the presence of a good friend, or for a child, the presence of a parent, can actually lower those cortisol levels and maybe increase positive hormones like oxytocin and things like that. And so that's going to have a long-term effect on your health.
Lydia says researchers have also found that our friendships can impact our immune systems.
So people who are much lonelier, they are more susceptible to inflammation and they're more susceptible to viruses than people who are more socially connected. And you can actually see the difference in the way their genes are operating.
How do researchers study all of this? Here is one pretty wild example. Long before social distancing was a thing, a researcher named Sheldon Cohen put a bunch of people in social isolation in a hotel for a couple of days. Before sending them into lockdown, he counted how many different types of social relationships each person had. Parents, spouses, children, work buddies, church friends, best friends. You get the idea.
And they put the cold virus up their noses.
Wow.
These are the things people do for science. And then they waited to see who got sick and who didn't. And what they found was that diversity of types of relationships was very protective.
One reason could simply be that you're exposed to more people, like a kid in a daycare, building up resistance.
But the researchers who did that study think that there was more to it than that. So the psychological actually is biological in many ways. And so if you feel you have support and you feel you have a network of people you can count on, that can be very protective. That knowledge can actually change what happens under your skin, inside your body.
So how many friends you have matters, but
the most important thing is quality. The biggest difference for your health is between having zero friends and one. So that's good news. It means that even if you only have one good friend or one person that you feel you can really count on and talk to in your life, that's going to help. It's going to make a big difference. And most people have only an average of about four friends in their inner circles.
Four is great, but Lydia says there are some benefits to having a large group of friends.
One reason that that's true is that it gives you a bench. It gives you more people to count on in different kinds of situations. Some people have different friends for different things. You know, in fact, there's a psychologist who dubs that emotionships. That, you know, if I'm anxious, I'm more likely to call the friend I think will calm me down and not the friend who also has a tendency to anxiety because she'll just ramp me up, right?
Our friends play different roles in our lives. The calm friend, the hiking friend, the friend who is also single or also has kids the same age, and so on. We look to our friends for shared experience. For Kara Scharf and Dakota Fisher-Vance, it was cancer that brought them together. Kara was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2011 when she was 25. Dakota was diagnosed that same year with a hereditary syndrome that predisposes her to different types of cancer. She's had colon cancer and a tumor.
When I got diagnosed, initially I wanted like cancer to infiltrate as little of my life as possible, including my social life. So I sort of put it, you know, in a box. And I didn't want to be the cancer girl. I was really afraid about my public perception. And I wanted to continue just being defined by all of the personality traits that had defined me before. But then when I got diagnosed with the tumor in 2013, it became clear that this just wasn't something that I could sort of stick to the side. It was going to really become part of my life, and I needed to learn how to live with that. And in order to do that, I needed to meet other people who could relate.
Dakota looked online, and she came across Stupid Cancer. That's an organization for young adults with cancer. They had a Facebook group for people in her region. She looked and looked until she saw somebody from Philadelphia.
And eventually I found a post from Kara, and total stranger, I Facebook messaged her, and fortunately she wasn't super freaked out by that, and asked if she wanted to meet for coffee, which we did. And she was the first young adult with cancer I ever met, and I don't know, it was a pretty helpful, transformative experience.
Yeah. Just to note that I was kind of the opposite when I first got diagnosed. I definitely, one of the first things I did was look up, resources for young adults with breast cancer. It was helpful to talk to other people, who had gone through chemo, who had, been diagnosed with breast cancer at such a young age. It was really nice to be part of that community in DC when I was going through everything. And so then when I was moving back to Philly, I was trying to find out if there was a similar community in Philly. And I couldn't really find anything, but I did put this post on that Facebook page. I guess I didn't really generate anything from that post until
a year later.
Until I got this message from Dakota and she wanted to meet up. And we did.
The organic nature that cancer comes up in our conversations. We could be talking about I don't like that food or something. We could be at a restaurant and could be like, oh yeah, when I was on chemo, I vomited every time that I tried to eat X or something. And then we can get right back to our conversation about how good the meal is. And I don't know, that organic nature is nice, as opposed to when you're with someone who hasn't had cancer, you have to formally bring it up. It's a big deal almost to be this one time when I had cancer, this happened.
Yeah, you imagine the other person just their eyes widening, being whoa, we're talking about that now? Okay. You know, there's a certain level of just unspoken understanding a lot of times between people who've been young adults and had cancer. It just seems easy with everyone that we've talked to kind of connect over these little themes that we all understand, because there's similar psychological things that I think we all go through.
I think even the coronavirus that Kara asked me a text yesterday about how I was feeling about all of this. And, as someone who's had cancer and of course might have some immune system challenges. And I just was wouldn't it be hilarious if I died of coronavirus instead of cancer? And that's not something I would generally put out there for everybody. So yeah, I think we definitely appreciate cancer humor, which usually makes people feel super awkward who haven't had cancer.
I would say in that same vein, talk about body or biological things. I'm a breast cancer survivor, so I had a mastectomy, I had my breasts removed, I have implants, and when I get together with Dakota or other young adults, we just throw everything out there. And I feel we aren't afraid to say to each other that we probably wouldn't talk to other people about, because we know that the other person is gonna understand.
Kara Scharf and Dakota Fisher-Vance are the co-founders of the Young Adult Cancer Connection. We'll put a link on our website, whyy.org/thepulse.
I would never ask you, how are you doing with, inflection on, how are you?
Pity.
which I think happens a lot in the non-cancer world.
Lydia Denworth is a science writer, and she just finished a book called Friendship: The Evolution, Biology, and Extraordinary Power of Life's Fundamental Bond. Earlier on, Lydia said there are three main ingredients in friendships: stability, positivity, and cooperation, give and take. But those also sound fundamental in a good marriage or a romantic relationship. Is there a difference when you research friendships? Is there really a difference between a friendship relationship and a, quote, romantic relationship? Can you really untangle that?
On one level, a friend is considered to be someone you don't have sex with. I mean, yeah. At its most basic, right? Although even that is not really true, because on the one hand, we sometimes joke about, or we talk about, friends with benefits. And then on the other, we often, especially in Western cultures, we often like to think of our romantic partners and our spouses as our best friends. So, you know, what's going on there? Romantic relationships, obviously, they have a whole other dimension to them. They have intimacy and sexual relations in a way that that's separate. If you want to talk about friendship, though, the question still is this person someone that makes you feel good and about yourself and about the relationship? Is this someone you can rely on? And I think that this new science of friendship blurs some of the lines.
Friends or lovers? Lovers and friends? It can get complicated. Jed Slayman looked into this.
Steve Lehman was a college senior near Philly when he started to realize something wonderful and terrifying.
We were hanging out just like we'd always hung out since freshman year. And I would look over and I would just think, like, oh my God, I'm in love with one of my best friends.
He was looking over at Katya Shipiatsky, a senior at a different school. They'd hung out for a few years as close friends, but things were changing now.
There were multiple times throughout the semester where Katya and I were hanging out one-on-one. And each time I would have, like, the urge to tell her how I felt about her. And I stopped myself each time.
He was afraid. But again, this is senior year. Life is short. Things finally came to a head one night as Steve and Katya finished a Bruce Springsteen documentary on Netflix.
I thought, this is it. I have to say something. Like, I cannot let this movie end and not tell Katya how I feel about her.
It was just the two of them, in the dark, Netflix and Bare Your Soul. The boss said something beautiful about life and love to end the movie. Katya and Steve both cried as the credits rolled, and Katya was struck by how moved Steve was.
Yeah, I had never seen Steve cry before. And I'm not usually, like, a physical, like, touchy person. Like, I'm not super, like, touchy with people. But, yeah, I felt like I had to do something.
Meanwhile, Steve was seconds from telling her everything.
Like, it's now or never. And I looked over at her, and before I could even say anything, she reached over and took my hand. And I think if there was any doubt in my mind, like, that gesture totally erased it.
He remembers his voice was shaky.
I think my words were, I know this is gonna sound cheesy after, like, watching this, but I have to tell you that I had a huge crush on you.
It was one of the biggest, like, shocks in my life. I imagine my face looking something kind of like the little, like, surprise emoji.
She had no idea it was coming. He had no idea what she'd say. For Steve, it wasn't just garden variety rejection at stake here. Remember, this wasn't some cute girl shooting him down at a party. That's his friend sitting there. Cross-sex friendships among heterosexual people are common, but a relatively recent thing in most societies.
One of the foundations of friendship is equality. You've got to see one another as equals.
Heidi Reeder is a Boise State communication professor. She says as a society becomes more equal, more possibilities for true friendship emerge.
Throughout most of history, men and women have been kept relatively separate. It wasn't until really the feminist movement that women could move into the workplace and that they weren't kept as much in isolation.
With cross-sex friendship, Heidi says there's basically four types of initial attraction that can occur.
The first is, and the most common, is friendship attraction. Just, you know, gosh, I just really like this person.
Then there's the romantic.
I could see us being boyfriend, girlfriend, getting married, etc.
The last two are types of physical attraction. One is subjective. He's beautiful to me. The other, objective. I can see how other people think she's sexy. And the attractions between two people don't always match.
If there is unmatched attraction at some point, someone has physical sexual attraction, the other one doesn't, someone has romantic attraction, the other one doesn't, that they find a way to resolve that and let that go and really decide, you know what, friendship is actually the priority here.
With Steve and Katya, that's kind of what happened. Katya first met Steve in a mutual friend's dorm, a kind of casual get-together. She thought he was just so cool.
Sometimes he would even do like a denim-on-denim look, but it didn't look stupid. It like looked cool.
Denim-on-denim was cool to Katya, somehow. Subjective attraction. She initially had a kind of mini crush.
I dismissed it because he seemed like really cool, like too cool for me.
Katya had been a real introvert before college, and actually so was Steve.
Seeing my friends every day in school was enough social interaction for me. Like I didn't need more. So I would go home and do homework, and on weekends I like wouldn't really hang out with people.
But neither knew that about the other. Steve says he noticed Katya in the, yeah, she's pretty hot sense, but he too dismissed the attraction. They were forming a cool friend group between their dorms. Both quietly figured a romantic relationship would just muck things up. The more their friendship developed, the more interesting it got.
So there's a lot of gender norms that go along with same-sex friendships, and you get the opportunity to kind of break some of those gender norms.
That's Heidi again, the Boise State researcher. She says folks report a strange freedom in cross-sex friendships. Guys get more vulnerable, reveal more of their inner lives, and women shed the caring listener role.
It allows one to access a sort of a different part of their personality. There's less conflict, there's less rules. You know, just be yourself.
Steve and Katya both tell me about their first summer as friends in Philadelphia. It was all art museums and parks, and often it was just the two of them. Katya called their time together liberating.
Like, it was nice to be able to just talk about art or talk about, like, what kinds of books I was reading or how I was feeling about my internship and not have to, like, delve into, like, you know, trying to, like, theorize about why, like, boys ghost girls.
And Steve says their talks had a unique richness that others didn't.
And not even, I feel like easy to talk to is one thing, but like a joy to talk to.
So Steve, eventually he started having different feelings for Katya, more than friends. How does that happen? I ask UC Davis researcher Paul Eastwick why some friends become more than.
All I can say is that I'm pretty confident we don't know.
He studies how romantic relationships start.
We have no evidence that there's anything you can assess about two people before they meet that will have any bearing on whether they're going to like each other or whether they're going to form a relationship or anything along those lines.
A lot of it is a mystery, but Paul's learned a lot from studying couples and holding experimental speed dating events. First off, he learned first impressions are all about looks. Both men and women made a big deal about physical attractiveness in choosing who they might date. But he also learned first impressions don't really matter in the long run. Only about 5% of speed daters ever saw each other again.
What we realized was that it's actually quite challenging to introduce people to each other from scratch when they have not met the other person before and expect to watch a romantic relationship appear before your eyes.
He says most romantic relationships tend to bubble up out of your friend or acquaintance group, people you know for a while, people you may call friends.
And if you ask people in general, how long did you know each other before you started this relationship? The answer usually on average is about a year. And I think that answer often surprises people.
So, okay, back to Steve and Katya. They really know each other. And Steve, back in that Netflix glow, he had already staked his position, put his cards on the table, told Katya he had a huge crush on her. No turning back now. It was time for Katya's answer.
He was probably, like, pretty annoyed with me. I would have been very annoyed with me.
She didn't really give him a yes or no, said she had to think about it. And then they went on winter break. Steve started doing the mental prep work for the no.
I was sure that she did not feel the same way. I was, like, positive. I think part of that was I didn't want to allow myself to think that she did like me, because then if she didn't, I'd be so much more sad.
Weeks went by, and then finally, over FaceTime, she told him, yes.
Like, I couldn't believe what I just heard. It was like a combination of disbelief and, like, ecstasy.
Katya took so long to answer because of a bunch of what ifs.
What if this is a bad idea? Like, what if this doesn't work? What if, like, we try it and it's, like, weird? And what if we're, like, not compatible?
What if this relationship fails and I lose a boyfriend and my best friend? A lot was at stake for her, too. Bill Rollins has studied friendship since the 70s, and he could have maybe shared some comforting science. He's found that couples that report they're also friends have better marriages.
Because since they were friends, it helped them get through really tough times in their relationship.
I tell Bill the story of Katya and Steve, how they started out as just friends before Steve finally made his confession. First off, Bill kind of takes offense at the phrase just friends. Like, what do you mean just?
Because, you know, you have Aristotle saying the 4th century BCE, you know, he says, you know, life is not worth living without friends. Okay. And I have heard people say that, you know, 100 years old, and their later adults say, my life wouldn't have been worth living without my friends.
He says that hierarchy of friends below or less intense than lovers is meaningless. One's not more important than the other in his mind, but there is an interplay.
I'll tell you this. When you look at people who have been friends before they become lovers, they're nicer to each other, typically. You know, when you do that dance of the scorpions, you know, I'll be wrapped around your finger, you'll be wrapped around my finger. And you, like, withhold commitment and, you know, no, I'm not going to text him. You know, she was text me, she can text, and play all that withholding of commitment.
Instead, he says friends are more likely to be open, to say what they want to say, and to give each other what he calls these two gifts.
I gift you the freedom to be independent from me, because I want what's best for you. So at the end of the college, if you find a job in Paris, you got to do that, Jad. You've always wanted to go to Paris, okay? So that's the freedom to be independent. But at the same time, I gift you the freedom to be dependent. And I say, but I just want you to know, if you need me, I'm here for you.
After a short semester and summer together as a couple, Steve and Katya both moved abroad to Spain and Russia, respectively.
When each of us are having bad days where we are, I'm so impressed and amazed at how she can handle them. She's very strong.
I ask both Steve and Katya, look, you could have had all this time together as a blissful couple, only a short drive apart. Do you regret not saying how you felt earlier, spending those years together as just friends?
I wouldn't trade them for anything.
No, I wouldn't change a thing.
It's a hard no. An answer, I imagine, after Bill's heart. For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman. He's just a friend. Don't give me that. Don't even give me that. You bust this. You got what I need. But you say he's just a friend.
And here's a little update. Since Jad reported this story, Katya and Steve came home from Russia and Spain as the coronavirus spread. They are now closer than ever in quarantine at Katya's mom's house in Denver.
How are you feeling?
things are going well. We're both a little exhausted and jet lagged, but I'm really happy to be here. I'm happy we're both healthy so far, knock on wood.
Yeah, me too. I'm very happy to be here in Denver with Katya.
We're talking about friendships and what scientists are learning about this bond that has such a major impact on our lives. If you're looking for new friends, a bunch of apps promise to match you up. But does this really work? Last year, reporter Buffy Gorilla was living far away from home in Melbourne, Australia, and she decided to give this a try.
Thank you for being a friend.
The friendship apps work pretty much like dating apps. Swipe right on smiling faces, hope that person swipes on you too, and see if you can make a connection. I'm trying two platforms where women can find female friends. Let's start with Bumble.
I think I'm going to swipe on this person. So that is swipe right. I feel like this picture that I'm looking at is for someone who thinks that this is a dating profile. This person is a mom. Not that there's anything wrong with that. All right, I'm gonna hit hey to this person. This is very judgmental. Oh, I see cats. That's a deal breaker. I'm gonna swipe left. Oh, no, I didn't do that right. I swiped right on accident. This person looks pretty interesting. She has a great profile photo. She looks very friendly. Her name is Ange. She is 39 and is a marketing officer. She has lived overseas, likes travel and yoga. I'm gonna give her a swipe and see what happens. And then I get a notification. Ange swiped on me too. We're a match. We agree to meet at an outdoor cafe in downtown Melbourne, Australia.
A lot of my friends are married with kids, and although they're really great friends, I just find it really hard to be able to connect with them anymore because their priority is their kids and their family, and when we do eventually meet up, it's always about their kids.
Ange has been on the app for about 3 months.
And what has the response been? It's been quite mixed. In the last 3 months, I've actually made 3 really good friends, probably out of maybe at least 30 people that I have met.
You've gone on 30 friendship dates.
Yeah, like I've really made the effort to really go out and meet them because I just feel like there's only so much you can chat online to get a sense of who they are. But I found a lot of them kind of drop off the face of the earth.
And do you ever get nervous about meeting the new people?
No. No.
Like today, no nerves?
No, more excited really. Yeah.
I have to say I was a little nervous. Because you're the first person I've met.
Oh, really? Oh, thank you.
After that first meeting with Ange, we never saw each other again. I just didn't feel a connection, and it seems like she didn't either. And that's okay. I head back on the apps for some more swiping. Finding friends using technology was a lot harder than I thought it would be. I swiped through a lot of faces. I'd start conversations just to have them fade away. Then I decided to try one called Hey Vina. It asked me a bunch of questions to get started, so the algorithm can get to know me better. Good luck, algorithm. Coffee, wine, or both coffee. Introvert, extrovert, or an ambivert. Ambivert. While I was swiping through Hey Vina, I saw one of my real life friends, Emma, so I thought, why not invite her over? Hello.
Hi, how you going?
Good, come on in.
Thanks.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, you too.
Would you like some tea?
Yeah.
Can we read your bio?
Oh, okay, this is excruciating. I've been in Melbourne for a few years and I'm looking to meet new people as I work from home and my dog isn't that talkative.
Over mugs of ginger tea, Emma tells me about a recent breakup.
In the last little part of my life, I've probably felt the loneliest that I've ever felt. And I think there's a whole bunch of reasons to do with that. And I think it doesn't matter whether you're in a relationship or you're not.
Emma says that making new friends on the app requires more effort than she's prepared to give right now.
I have to admit, I've not been particularly active on there. I kind of like was like, yeah, I'll do this thing. It'll be great. And then life happened. And I was like, that's just one more thing I now have to do, which is respond to these people. So apologies, people who swiped on me. I will get back to you.
Emma and I are still friends, but I've moved away. I'm starting over again in a new city, so perhaps I'll be back on the friendship apps before too long. As for Emma, she's now using apps to find love. And last we spoke, she's meeting some lovely fellas. Thanks, technology.
That story was reported by Buffy Gorilla. Coming up, when friendships end, it can be really painful.
Maria, this letter might end up seeming harsh or drastic.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. Greater Philadelphia's research institutions, collaborative spirit, capital, support for entrepreneurs, and quality of life are attracting leading life sciences firms. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about friendship and what researchers are learning about the role of friends in our lives. Many friendships sort of fizzle out naturally. You see each other less and less, and then kind of not at all. No hard feelings, some fond memories, and an occasional, hey, how are you? We need to catch up kind of message. But some friendships end with a massive blow up. Steph Yin looked into why that can feel so painful.
Maria, this letter might end up seeming harsh or drastic.
This is Maria. They're an artist living in Philadelphia, and they want us to just use their first name. One night last August, as Maria was winding down for the day, they got an email from their friend. Let's call her Pam.
I need to cut you off because of emotional stress it's been causing me and my health. I need to stop surrounding myself with people that are toxic. I've had to shut my mouth for the last 7 years.
Maria did not see this coming.
I was like shaking. I could not wrap my head around it. Out of the blue, and I was just really not even thinking that that's what it was going to be about. It was like a nightmare.
The letter went on and on, picking apart things Maria had said or posted online, even the name they chose for their dog.
There are very specific things taken from all 7 years of our friendship. You know, it goes back really far, and then like goes into like just very much attacking me. In different ways.
Before this, Maria considered Pam a really close friend. The friends lived together for 3 years of art school. The summer after graduating, they both stayed in Baltimore, where they went to school, and spent a lot of time together. It was a carefree period. They'd go to parks or hang out at their place and talk about the future or problems in their love lives.
We were like 21 at that point, so we could just go casually buy wine, which was like cool and new, you know, to just like hang out in our house and drink wine.
After college, Maria and Pam grew apart a bit. Maria noticed it became harder to find time for each other. Still, the fact that Pam seemed to have felt so differently about their friendship for years, it really took Maria off guard. How does this kind of thing happen?
There are not going to be tons of lifelong friends that we take along for the 70, 80, 90 years we're on this earth.
Suzanne Deggs White is a professor of counseling at North Illinois University who studies how friendship changes over time. She says it's normal for us to lose friends as life evolves. Friendships are particularly brittle around transitions, leaving home, going from college to young adulthood, partnering up, having kids. Each time your circumstances change, you kind of look around and take stock, intentionally or not.
You know, is this a friendship I want to keep investing in? Is it someone who I value? Or is it really a friendship that I need to let go?
There's this narrative out there that friendships should just flow.
That's Miriam Kermeyer, a clinical psychologist in Montreal.
That it should just be easy and that we shouldn't necessarily need to communicate about the difficult things or experiences that we're having.
She says there are some social expectations that friends should just be fun or polite with each other, that we shouldn't be, quote unquote, too much with friends.
People are often very hesitant to have those conversations with their friends to say, look, I've noticed that we're growing apart, or here's what I'm finding difficult, or here are what my needs are, and here are the ways that I'm not feeling as though those are being met. And I see that people overestimate the likelihood of those conversations going badly or poorly, when really those can often be a means not just for problem solving, but for closeness.
Miriam does think writing a letter can be helpful. She often encourages her clients to do that, but she tells them not to actually send the letter.
Ultimately, I think the goal of those kinds of letters should either be to process our own feelings and decide that we're okay with the place that we're in, or allow us to prepare to have those difficult conversations and come into it feeling as though we know what we want to say, we know where we stand, and we know what our hopes are.
When Pam sent her letter to Maria, she gave explicit instructions for Maria not to respond. To Maria, it seemed like Pam had no faith that the two of them could work things out, and that didn't feel like how friends should treat each other.
A huge part of this letter that was such a shock and so hard for me was that nothing had been talked about, and I just feel like the friendship could have been salvaged if we maybe had talked about it.
I recapped the situation between Maria and Pam to Shayna Ali, a mental health counselor in Florida. I told her how Maria did not at all see this coming. Shayna said a couple things could be happening here.
The first is it because you were not attentive to the relationship that maybe there were hints provided, maybe the friend provided effort in addressing this with you and you may have missed those signs?
This isn't to place blame, Shayna says, but just to consider that one person may have thought the signs were clear and the other person totally missed them. Or the letter really could have come out of nowhere. Shayna says sometimes people quote-unquote ghost because they fear conflict, and jumping ship just seems like the easy way out. In reality, ghosting can be painful and anxiety-inducing on both ends. Shayna says if you're thinking of ending things with a friend, it's worth really thinking through it.
Take a moment and step back.
She says it doesn't have to get nasty. Think about the entirety of your relationship and remember that your friend is human and complex. When you zoom out, does the good outweigh the bad? If the friendship goes way back, are there memories you would miss sharing with someone?
Could you be missing some of these other times that the friend has been there for you, that has supported you, that has stood up for you?
Also, think about your own role. Is there anything you could have done differently? In the end, you might still decide to end the friendship, but you'll have started down a path of reflection and processing. And if the relationship was meaningful to you, there will be a grieving process.
In order to heal through it, you have to go through it. So you'd have to really acknowledge the amount of pain that came from it and the misunderstanding, the disrespect, the pain. Then you can heal through it.
That story was reported by Steph Yin. Scientists are learning a lot about human friendships from studying animals. Some animals do form something akin to what we think of as friendship. I mean, not like in a Disney movie, but meaningful relationships. It's usually animals that live in stable, bonded social groups, like primates, whales, or horses. But sometimes friendships happen with animals that are not really candidates for that kind of relationship. Liz Tong has this example.
It's not every day you get to witness a historic bromance, but that's exactly what I got to see on a recent visit to the Philadelphia Zoo.
Yes, that's Balawat right there under the climbing structure, and then Baloo's over here in the grasses.
The lead bear keeper at the Philly Zoo, Lauren Atkins, is showing me their sloth bears, Baloo and Balawat. They look kind of like the American black bear's eccentric uncle. They're a bit smaller and lankier, with long, pale snouts and tufts of hair that poke out from their ears.
They do kind of resemble sloths in that they have shaggy fur, they have long front claws that are really great for digging and climbing.
Baloo and Balawat each have their own separate dens, but a few times a day, they're released into a shared yard where they play, hang out, or dig around for some bugs to eat.
So again, you know, them just foraging near each other, it's still being social, you know, they're not showing any kind of, stress or aggressive behavior, so they're just doing their bear thing.
Like Lauren said, normal bear stuff. Except for the fact that none of this is normal. Because sloth bears, like all bears, are solitary animals. If they met up in the wild, Lauren says, would probably be seeing something very different.
So it would be much more aggressive. You'd be hearing a lot.
Specifically, yelling. Something like this.
It would be a territory thing. They would fight over the right to mate. And then they have food sources, of course, because food is very important to all animals.
In addition to being solitary, sloth bears are one of the most aggressive bear species in the world. So what is going on here? How did these two end up as best buds? Here's the backstory. Sloth bears hail from the rainforests of Sri Lanka and India. And in recent years, they've become threatened thanks to habitat destruction, along with illegal poaching. Because of that, American zoos have become hyper-focused on breeding sloth bears. Both Baloo and Balawat were born and raised in American zoos. Balawat's 14, Baloo's 7. He was the first one to come to Philadelphia.
Baloo came to us at 2.5 years old.
With future baby sloth bears in mind, they put Baloo together with a young female named Kayla, who was also born in captivity.
They were too young to breed, but we knew that that social bond was there, and they really did enjoy being together.
Then, last summer, they discovered that Kayla was pregnant, which meant she and Baloo had to be separated, because male sloth bears are liable to attack and kill cubs, even their own. Lauren says Kayla was actually pretty happy to have her own space. But Baloo...
Bummed might be a good word. He definitely would look for her.
They could see him nosing around the door to Kayla's den. The zoo staff tried to keep Baloo occupied, but he still seemed a little listless.
So you could kind of tell that he was looking for that interaction.
Around the same time, Donna Evernham, a curator at the Philly Zoo, was talking sloth bears with a colleague over at the Cleveland Zoo.
And he and I were just talking about, you know, their male and our male, and that our male seems to really appreciate companionship.
He told Donna their male did too. His name was Balawat, and like Baloo, he'd recently been separated from his mate thanks to the birth of a cub. This turned out to be a light bulb moment for Donna and her Cleveland colleague. It was so obvious. Why not put Baloo and Balawat together? So the two zoos conspired to set the bears up on a mandate. But remember, sloth bears are solitary animals, and again, one of the most aggressive bear species in the world. Male and female mates were one thing, but pairing up two males for companionship, it had never been done, at least as far as they knew.
So the worst case scenario would have been that they didn't get along and they were aggressive to the point that one of them was injured.
So they introduced Baloo and Balawat as carefully as possible, putting them in adjacent dens where they could smell and hear each other, but not see one another. After a week came the official introduction through a small mesh window where they saw each other for the first time. Lauren Atkins, the Philly Zoo bear keeper, says as soon as that happened, the two bears got very excited.
So they were very, very adamantly trying to open that door, and they were popping at each other.
Translation, a happy sound that sloth bears make.
Usually it's kind of a greeting. It's kind of a, there's something exciting happening right now.
It was looking pretty promising. The bears were chatting. There was no yelling, no evidence of fear or aggression.
So there was just so much positive, you know, interaction between the two of them that Donna and I and our other relief keepers were like, I think we're going to give this a go and open up the door.
Baloo and Balawat immediately jumped on one another and started wrestling. They spent the next week chasing each other around the yard, even playing vertical tag up and down the trees, much to the delight of visitors.
To see them playing, to see them wrestling is really exciting. That's great exercise for them. You know, it's good mental stimulation for them.
So far, they've been together for about 6 months. In the meantime, both of their mates have been busy as mama bears. It'll be a while until those cubs can be separated from their mothers. Until then, Baloo and Balawat are going to stay together. Two bachelors, just having a good time.
That was Liz Tung reporting. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And we've made a playlist for the show. If you're missing your friends right now, check out the songs we've put together. We'll put a link on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jed Slayman, and Steph Yin. Our intern is Sabrina Ems. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Stay healthy and wash your hands.
'Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse' is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.